It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new Dr. Seuss book is on the way. We'll talk to a Seuss expert about the discovery of the late author's lost work and why he has such staying power.
First, a new national report shows that Wisconsin high schools suspend black students at the highest rate in the country. Milwaukee Public High Schools in particular stuck out with a suspension rate of 33% for all students, three times the national average.
The report, titled "Are We Closing the School Discipline Gap?" comes from UCLA's Civil Rights Project. It highlights the racial disparities in discipline and the impact of suspensions on achievement. Joining us now is the lead author of the report, Daniel Lowson. He's also director of the Center for Civil Rights Remedies at UCLA's Civil Rights Project. Later, we'll be joined by Milwaukee Journal Sentinel education reporter Aaron Richards. Daniel Lowson, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
First of all, when you see high suspension rates and a big disparity between races like we're talking about, what does that say to you about a school district or a system?
Well, it really suggests that there are excessive uses of out-of-school suspensions. And we know, even though this study did not have any data on the reasons for suspensions, in the states where we have looked at those reasons, the leading reason for suspension is usually disruption, willful defiance. They're breaking school rules that have been broken that are very minor. These are not primarily dangerous acts or illegal drugs. In fact, none of the data that we are discussing include expulsions. So that's a separate entity entirely. And those are usually reserved for the most serious offenses.
But if students are creating a disruptive environment, isn't there this balancing act between trying to keep them in the classroom and the experience of the other 20-plus kids in the room? Isn't there a need sometime to remove that student so other students can focus?
Well, absolutely. You know, an out-of-school suspension, it really has no benefits, not only for the kids or for the class, because these kids return a few days later, and they're not better behaved. They're further behind, they're more disengaged, more likely to drop out. And there are many things short of out-of-school suspension that can be done to improve behavior. So the alternative is often this false dichotomy between just kicking lots of kids out or accepting chaos. And nobody is endorsing any kind of chaos. In fact, one study of all school districts across the state of Indiana found the principals who had clear rules and enforced them fairly but had low suspension rates had higher achievement than those principals who astounded towards sort of a zero-tolerance mentality, and that's after controlling for race and poverty. So it's just a myth that you have to somehow kick out the quote-unquote bad kids. And when you're talking about 34%, more than one out of every three black secondary student across the state, that's just incredibly high rate of out-of-school suspensions, and that's Milwaukee's rate. It's the highest in the nation. There are, in fact, though, even in Milwaukee, more low-suspending secondary schools than high-suspending ones. So it's also just not the case that we don't know how to do it. There are schools across the state as well as across the country, secondary schools, that have much lower suspension rates. And I should also add that we have a book of new research called Closing School Discipline Gap, that is a compilation of leading scholars across the country who have studied different districts where they have found very effective alternatives where we don't have to have this sort of choice between either kick the kids out or have chaos.
Let's get into how to tackle that gap, because one of the big take-homes from Wisconsin is this big gap between white students and black students. Black students suspended way more. So if you're talking to a district administrator, a principal, what are the first things you would suggest they do to reduce that gap?
Well, one of the obvious ones, we call them the low-hanging fruit. To the extent that any districts are suspending kids for truancy, there's no deterrent value there. If they're suspending kids for dress codes and they're concerned about gangs, well, the leading predictor of gang involvement is disengagement from school. And suspending students out of school for a dress code is going to push them into the arms of gang members, not the other way around. So it's really, getting rid of some of the minor offenses. The state of California just eliminated suspensions for disruption and willful defiance for all students in grades K through 3. And Los Angeles, that has a remarkably low suspension rate in the midst of improving graduation rates, I should add, has eliminated that category for all kids K through 12. I should also note that there are other large cities like Baltimore City in Maryland that have, relative to the state of Wisconsin, much, much lower rates. And during the period where they really made an effort to find alternatives, they improved the graduation rates at the same time. So they really have found, there are well-documented successes in alternatives and ways to reduce racial disparities. Another large district, Denver, Colorado, invested in something called restorative practices, which really holds kids accountable more so than just kicking them out of school. Some kids, that's a reward, in fact. With restorative practices, students are held accountable to the people they either hurt or the property they damage, but they also invest a lot of adult time and community time in finding out why is the student misbehaving and providing the supports so that student can be part of the community in a successful way and improve their behavior. And during the period this approach was adopted throughout the district in Denver, every grade level improved their test score for their test scores for every single racial and ethnic group in every subject. So there are lots of effective alternatives. I taught for 10 years, and I can tell you my first year I was kicking kids out of my classroom right and left. And by my last year, I never once thought of sending a student to the principal's office.
Daniel, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks again.
We'll bring on now Aaron Richards, education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Aaron, thanks for joining us again.
Sure. Happy to be here.
So in your piece, spinning off from this report, you looked back at some of the history behind Milwaukee's suspension rates. What's the long-term trend that you looked at?
It looks like 2007-2008 was one of the peak years in MPS for the number of students suspended. The data really peaked that year, and that was the same year that a different national report took a look at those numbers and said, holy cow, you guys might be the highest suspending district in the country overall, not even talking about racial disparities, although there were some. The district has tried since then a variety of strategies to try to lower that rate. That work has really picked up in the last few years with a new behavior program they've implemented. It's somewhat complicated, but the idea is to start trying to reward kids for what they're doing right, which is often harder to notice, right? If kids are walking down the hallways the way they should be or raising their hands to speak, it's sometimes harder to remember to praise kids for doing that kind of thing. It's easier to see that something's going wrong than it is to sometimes see something going right. So the district has been lowering its rates since then. Even in the last 2 years alone, overall in the district, state data shows there were more than bordering on 40,000 incidents in 2011-2012. By the next year, 2012-13, that had dropped to about 27,000 incidents. And those are not weapon or drug related. Those are reported incidents of some kind of infraction. So definitely the district has lowered the number of incidents and lowered the rate of suspension even since this report was issued. The question is, are classrooms actually operating better, or are teachers just really being encouraged to not send kids out of class? I've heard from a lot of people today online that have said, hey, you know, this doesn't, just because the suspension rate's going down doesn't mean our classrooms are any easier to manage.
We'll pick up that question in a few as we talk to Aaron Richards from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about a new national report naming Wisconsin as having the highest rate of suspensions for black students of any state in the country. We heard also from Dan Lowson, lead author of a new report that Aaron Richards is talking about.
We're continuing our conversation about suspension rates in Wisconsin. A new report shows that Wisconsin has the highest suspension rate for black students in the country. We're talking to Milwaukee Journal Sentinel education reporter Aaron Richards.
You could join in. What has your experience been with suspension in the schools, how it works, what it does to the students? Have you experienced it, or maybe your kid? If you work in the schools, what do you make of all this? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Jen in Madison with us. Jen, hi.
Hi. I used to teach in Milwaukee, actually, at Edison Middle School, my first 2 years of teaching. And I have to say, you are not prepared. I went to school in Stevens Point University, and they don't teach you in college how to have a discipline plan, what works with kids, how to connect with your students. I now teach in Madison, and I've been here since 91. I taught in 89, 90, 90, 91 at Edison. And I had a really good rapport with my students there. But part of it had to do with reaching out to the families and calling and making positive connections with those families and with the kids and letting the kids know, this is what I expect. I'm not going to go down from this. And, you know, you will come up to meet these expectations.
Jen, thanks a lot for that call. Aaron, is this looked at as part of the solution to avoid suspensions, getting better, I guess, training for teachers and dealing with those in-class issues of discipline?
Jen makes a really good point, because there's been several reports that have shown how little that education schools tend to focus on an area known as classroom management. That means everything from handling behavior to figuring out how to organize yourself. But that area is really just not focused on very much at the sort of the traditional education schools that have a lot more theory and, you know, sort of science of learning type issues. And absolutely, I mean, I think one thing that the report has referred to in some of these districts that have made gains in their suspension rates is how critical it is to have relationships with the families. The problem is that's tough to do on school time. That takes time and effort and energy outside of school. I'd love to hear from more teachers about how they manage to do that, especially in high needs districts where a lot of families, you know, may be disengaged or tough to reach.
Got a Facebook message from Jackie. She writes, my son has been suspended nearly 10 times in suburban Milwaukee schools before the age of 8. I'm considering homeschooling at this point. Aaron, when I think of suspensions, I'm thinking junior high school era. Are we seeing a high suspension rate in elementary, lower elementary in this case?
Well, certainly it's lower at the elementary schools usually than it is in high schools when kids are more independent. But even in the MPS schools, which is a district that has a lot of kindergarten through eighth grade schools, you absolutely see quite a few students suspended. Just the average rate in MPS K to 8 schools is about 20%. So that's almost one in five kids being suspended at pretty young ages. Now, middle schools tend to skew it a little bit. There are probably the most number of incidents per 1,000 students in Milwaukee anyway at the middle school level. You know, for these types of things. But I think that's kind of another shadow area, is those younger grades where it's like, you know, what's going on at this level? In Madison, they've implemented a policy recently that forbids people from issuing out-of-school suspensions to kids that are younger than fourth grade.
So is there an effort to make in-school, outside of your home classroom, alternatives to suspension?
That's a great question, and it's an area that isn't tracked well by the data. Since this report came out, I've asked Milwaukee Public Schools if they can provide the figures for how many in-school suspensions they're issuing. Under the idea of, you know, if your out-of-school suspensions are going down, but your in-school suspensions are going up, that could indicate that more of those kids are being kept in school for, you know, penalties that would be in school rather than out of school. But that data isn't tracked prominently by the state, so it's more of a district-by-district issue, and I think that that's an area where, you know, certainly it can vary from school to school, but what are other ways that you can discipline a child for their behavior but not necessarily send them home?
Aaron, do we have a sense from research out there of the impact of suspensions on the student academically and beyond?
Well, it's certainly, you know, there's a correlation in the data between districts that have high suspension rates. That generally means that kids are out of school. Research shows, and common sense would indicate, the more a child is out of school, the less they are learning, the less high achieving they'll be. And we certainly have data to show that, you know, the less you achieve, the more likely you are to drop out. The more likely you are to drop out can feed right into crime statistics and imprisonment. those are a lot of, those are a lot of steps, but they certainly do feed on each other. And Daniel Lozen, the lead author of this report, has pointed to the fact that districts that have a documented and, you know, sort of effective strategy for lowering suspensions have seen a corresponding uptick in achievement.
We'll leave it there. Aaron, thank you, as always, for joining us.
Thanks.
We speak with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel education reporter Aaron Richards about a new report that Wisconsin has the highest suspension rate for black students in the country. Earlier, we heard from Daniel Lozen, lead author of the study. You can continue the conversation over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Today is Read Across America Day, an effort by the National Education Association to promote reading and literacy for kids. And it's set to coincide with the birthday of an author with that same mission, Theodore Geisel, better known as Dr. Seuss.
And there's been some breaking Seuss news lately. There is a new Dr. Seuss book on the way. Last month, publishers announced that the late author's previously unreleased book, What Pet Should I Get?, will be published this summer. Draws on writings and drawings found in a box by his wife.
Philip Nell joins us now. He's a professor of English at Kansas State University. His books on children's literature include Dr. Seuss, American Icon. Phil, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Phil, the book isn't out yet, but what do we know so far about What Pet Should I Get?
Well, we know that the working title was Pet Store, and that it's one of the manuscripts that was found when Audrey Geisel, his widow, donated some material to Special Collections at the University of California at San Diego a couple of years ago. And when they did that, there was actually a news story, and they printed photographs of some of the stuff that was in there, and there is actually a page from the Pet Store in the photograph of that. So we do know a little bit of text from it. I can read it to you if you want.
Sure.
Yeah.
Then I looked at Kay. I said, what will we do? I like all the pets that I see. So do you. But we cannot take all the pets that we find. We have to pick one. Can you make up your mind? Then what do you know? Then we saw something new, a pup and a kitten. Boy, they were good too. The cat or the dog or this kitten? The pup. Oh boy, it is something to make your mind up.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. Well, I don't want to rain on our Seuss parade, but is there any concern that this unpublished material shouldn't be published, at least not as a freestanding book, if Dr. Seuss didn't see this as a finished work?
Well, I haven't seen the finished work myself, so it's hard for me to know. It is useful to know, perhaps, that Seuss wrote far more than he published, and that was one of the reasons that some of the stuff that he published came out under the name Theo Lessig, Lessig being Geisel backwards. So it's possible this could have been a Lessig book that never got published. It's also possible that this could be an earlier version of One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish. The boy and the girl, who are the main characters in this book, are the same kids who are in One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish. So possibly we're seeing an earlier version of that. I don't know. I mean, the bottom line is, it's Seuss. So even if it's not the greatest Seuss, it's still going to be interesting, you know?
Well, you're a Seuss scholar. As someone who studies Dr. Seuss, how exciting is this for you to come across this new work that's going to be published? You haven't seen the whole thing, but what is it like for you?
Oh, it's always fun to see how Seuss's mind worked. And I've looked at drafts of other Seuss books, and it's fascinating to see his process. For those people who are writers, you already know this, but rewriting until he got just the swing and the rhythm of the verse that he wanted and the art that he wanted. So it's always great to have a glimpse of a creative genius at work. So it'll be fun.
It feels so fun and spontaneous, which I guess is a sure sign that a lot of work went into it behind the scenes.
Well, yeah, I mean, the draft page that I've seen the photograph of, you can see that he's revised the verse several times. There's little pieces of paper that are taped to the artwork, and you can see that there's paper taped on top of paper on top of paper, so there's clearly earlier versions of the verse behind there. And of the manuscripts that I've looked at, that was typical. You know, he would write it out, and then he would change it and paste something over that, and then he would change that and paste something over that. So, you know, Seuss once said that to establish or to write a 60-page book, he may write over 1,000 pages before he was satisfied. And I don't think that's wrong. I mean, it may be a slight exaggeration in terms of the number of pages, but in terms of the amount of effort, yeah, that's about right.
We live in a world right now with a lot of children's books, a lot of children's books authors. What would you say makes Dr. Seuss unique, even today?
Even today, huh? Well, I think Seuss has established himself in the canon of great American children's writers because he taught generations of children not only how to read, but how to think. So with the beginner book series, starting with The Cat in the Hat, he was writing books that were designed to teach children to read, and books that were more interesting than, say, the Dick and Jane books. But then he also wrote books like The Sneetches, or Horton Hears a Who, or The Butter Battle Book, or The Lorax, which are about critical thinking, you know, about taking care of the environment or being opposed to discrimination. And I think the range of his creative ambitions there is part of what's made him so popular. And also that he delivers all this, whether it's a message like The Lorax, or whether it's something more purely fun like Green Eggs and Ham, in verse. And the rhythm of that verse, I think, keeps us reading, and it's you can almost sing the Dr. Seuss book. It's musical, and I think that's part of what his appeal is too.
Looking back from now, it seems like a no-brainer that this would have been successful. But how did the world of publishing and children's publishing react to Dr. Seuss? Did they embrace this right off the bat?
I mean, Seuss loved to tell the story of how hard it was to publish his first children's book, and to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street, which came out in 1937, that everybody turned it down and no one wanted to publish it because it was something that they hadn't seen before. And it's true. I mean, he had written several books before he got a children's book published in 1937. So initially, the reviews were okay when the books were published, but he did have a little bit of a hard time breaking in. And he didn't really make his living at writing children's books until 20 years after. And to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street, it wasn't until The Cat in the Hat in 1957 that writing children's books became his full-time occupation. Up until that point, his main job was advertisements. He was an ad man. That was how he made his money. So, yeah, I mean, I would say that although the reviews were positive and the sales were fine, he wasn't really devoted to the children's book gig for about 20 years, because that's what it took him to really become established.
How did he change that children's book world once he really was out there making his mark?
Well, I mean, I think he changed it in a number of ways, one of which is, making it okay to take children seriously, and he's certainly not the first person to do that, but, you know, his popularity allowed him to use his position as a children's writer to raise serious questions that, you know, some people thought weren't really appropriate for children. The Lorax, when it was published, was seen by some as kind of a heavy-handed, hard-sell, ecological fable. And it is that, but it's also a really serious and really important issue that is, in fact, more important now, I think, than it was in 1971 when the book was published. So I think, I think he used his position as an advocate for things that he believed in, and I think that's one of the ways that he changed it. And verse, I think, would be the other thing. When you see people today who maybe are celebrities and want to write a children's book, often they try to do it in verse, and it's usually not very good. It's usually bad imitation Seuss verse, but I think he's also pushed verse towards the center of what it means to write a children's book.
In the world of children's literature, who is there anyone you'd point to as really taking up the mantle of Dr. Seuss and maybe running with it in their own direction?
Oh, I think Mo Willems is probably the obvious choice.
Oh, one of my favorites.
Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus, and Elephant and Piggy, and the Knuffle Bunny books. But there are many others who share Seuss's subversive, playful spirit, from Lane Smith to Laurie Keller. Those are some others that come to mind. Lane Smith is probably best known for illustrating The Stinky Cheese Man and other Fairly Stupid Tales. And Laurie Keller is probably best known for The Scrambled States of America, but she's done a lot of other funny books. So I think anybody who kind of embraces that mischievous, playful spirit of Seuss and isn't afraid to push boundaries a bit.
Do you think today's readers are going to eat this up? Is this book going to be a hit?
Oh, I'm sure it will be. I mean, it's Seuss, so, you know, it's like a new Harry Potter book. You know, people don't even need to know what's between the covers. It's got Harry Potter's name on it. They'll buy it, and that's not a slight on Rowling. I enjoy the Harry Potter book. I just mean, you know, do you think people will buy more chocolate? Yes, they do. You know, so I think that's what we're dealing with. And you know, the collections of magazine stories that were published, I think, have done pretty well. There's been two of those in the last few years, and so it looks like we're in for more unpublished Seuss, and I'm okay with that.
Phil, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's Philip Nell, professor of English at Kansas State University. We've been talking about Dr. Seuss. His books on children's literature include Dr. Seuss, American Icon.